There, now, same.
There we go.
Same thing applies, right?
Okay, well, let's start with a little bit of background information on you. Could you state your full name, please?
Edward J. McBride.
And your date and place of birth?
March 13th, 1934, New Britain, Connecticut, United States.
Okay, can you describe your educational background?
Yes, I took my undergraduate degree with the Jesuits in Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York. It's one of three schools that the Jesuits run in New York State, Fordham and Canisius being the other two. And following the a Bachelor's of Social Science from Lemoyne College, I went to the Catholic University of America. And there I did my work up to the course level of doctoral work and received an MA in politics from the Catholic University of America in 1961. Do you want me to go into where I taught before?
Sure, and your research interests
yes.
too.
Okay. And for the first 6 years of my teaching career, I taught at St. Francis College in Loretto, Pennsylvania. That's near Pittsburgh. My research interest in the first part of my career were in American government, and as I moved here, I developed an interest in Canadian constitutional law. I had studied that before, comparative constitutional law, as a graduate student. I had done some constitutional law teaching at St. Francis, and I made that a major interest here, although I've continued to teach most years, not lately, but most years, American government as well. I am mainly interested, as far as writing, in the Canadian judiciary. And I have co-authored a book with a former student of mine, Randall Balcom, and a Dalhousie Law professor, Don Russell, entitled Supreme Court of Canada Decision Making. And that has exemplified my main focus of interest, which is in comparative constitutional law, but centered upon the Canadian judiciary, especially to the extent that the Canadian judiciary now, since the advent of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, is taking on a role akin to that of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Okay. When did you first come to St. Mary's?
I came to St. Mary's in the fall of 1967.
Okay, so what was your role when you first came?
Dr. William Dalton was chairman of the department at the time. He was the founding chairman. And in the first year of teaching at St. Mary's in political science in those days, you only had to teach two courses. He did that so that people settling in would have an advantage. And I taught American government and I taught an international relations course. After that, I continued to teach American government and then offered a section of the freshman course in review, plus sharing the plenary sessions and lecturing with Dr. Dalton and a couple of others. And within 2 or 3 years, though, I developed comparative constitutional law as a then new course offering at St. Mary's. And since then, I've offered it for 25 years. Until the last few years, I continued to teach an introductory section at St. Mary's, but given the press on our jurisprudence program within political science, I now just teach above the 200 level.
Okay. The size of the university has grown a great deal since 1960. How has that affected the university?
I know it's conventional to say that the size has risen so much that we're no longer the old St. Mary's. Maybe wish is father to the thought, but I dispute that a little. If I may, let me see if I can explain this in terms of I've given a lot of thought to this. Every institution has its own best view of itself. That's true of a Supreme Court. It's true of a presidency. All institutions that last over time have what's been called a history and a memory, sort of a collective, cumulative memory. And though St. Mary's is large by comparison to the St. Mary's I joined. And it's even fairly large by Canadian standards now. It's not by any means a small school. Our boast, where tradition meets the future, is an encapsulation of our own best view of ourselves as an institution. And we're an accessible university. That obviously means one thing as regards our size. We have grown because we are accessible, and accessible to a type of student that perhaps doesn't feel as comfortable in another school. I think of those who have disabilities, for one. But we are accessible in another sense, according to our own best view of ourselves. It's I think, best symbolized by the open door. That for purposes, say, of this interview, the door is closed, but when you came upon my office, the door was open, always is when I'm in. And we're accessible in that sense. St. Mary's now probably could bill itself as a fairly large university that still manages that sense of scale to keep it accessible for the students, to the professors especially. Now, having said all of that, I'd be the first to concede, having studied institutions throughout my career, first the President of the United States, then the Supreme Court of Canada, institutions don't always live up to their own best view of themselves. But that own best view of itself, of an institution, is rather a way of holding its collective feet to the fire. And I must tell you that in all the changes of scale at St. Mary's, I've never seen the institution in its own best view itself abandon this notion of accessibility, abandon this notion that however large we might grow, there still is an ideal. An ideal centered on the student, the student's progress. And that is not lost on certain of our undergraduates. I'd like to certainly think so in our program. It is certainly not lost on a good many of our alumni. They are quite interested in the progress of their successor students. And although they themselves may have gone through here when we were smaller, to the extent that you can convey to them that their successor students are receiving the same sort of interest, they take pride in St. Mary's. I received a letter from a student, past student. I always have a saying, we don't have former students. We have past students, we have former students. Okay. I received a letter from a past student this spring. And I had sent him some material about the progress of our people in what he went through at St. Mary's, jurisprudence within political science. And then he wrote back and said, this is the sort of thing I most vividly remember when I was at St. Mary's. And I can quote him directly. And this is what puts St. Mary's head and shoulders above any other university in town, which is a good thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I concede knowledge of the size, but it's really a sign of our success, not failure, that we've grown. The other point I'd make in respect to the size, there was a time at St. Mary's, I put it maybe the early 70s, when, again speaking about the collective sense within an institution, the self-confidence of the school was lower than it is now. It had to do with, we weren't so big then, and the marking out of some sort of distinctive place within the Nova Scotia complex of universities, that had not yet been done. And St. Mary's was still small enough then, perhaps to be threatened by the notion of, well, there's a larger school here that may someday come to absorb us. Such has been our success. That is no longer really a likely possibility for all the talk of reorganization. Mm-hmm. Most often St. Mary's seems to be rather on the assertive side of that, and Dell on the defensive. And now, I'm not here speaking about inter-institutional rivalry so much, because I have I think a close connection with the law school at Dalhousie, and have indeed collaborated with their professors on one book I mentioned before and another one previous to that. So it isn't a matter of rivalries, it's just a question of, well, what place did St. Mary's have? That was uncertain in the early 70s. It's not uncertain now. Probably more so than Dal, we are the accessible university in the province. Our own campaign fund notes our distinctiveness. I don't think they use exactly that word, but in the sense I've used it, we are an accessible university. And if anything, the changes in higher education, we, St. Mary's, have been able to master, let's say, better than some other schools, because we've had that tradition and we carry it forward. And I detect, and again, I may be generalizing from experience within my department, my faculty of arts, but I detect a greater self-confidence on that collective entity of St. Mary's than, say, in the early 70s.
So do you feel that your relationship with your students has changed over the years?
No, I must say that. That has been not accidental or coincidental. If there's anything I work at hardest, it is to maintain that sense with the students. And I always take great attach great significance to student commentaries in their evaluations, and I cast myself against myself. It's the only one I compete with is myself. And I am pleased to say that none of that has changed. The things they point out most frequently are the same as before. The interest, the motivation that you try to impart to them. Concern for their development, that sort of thing. That hasn't changed, and I can only go by that sort of response. As I say, it can be at some cost. You find yourself working maybe harder, really in a physical sense, physiological sense, working harder to do the same thing that you did before.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a difference. I certainly would say this, between, say, a class of 50 and a class of 70, if it's a mixed lecture participation, that extra 20 really causes you to press to get to know them, to get them to do enough by way of participatory and all the rest. Look at it like anything else, it's just a challenge.
Okay, let's talk about some changes that took place in the early years that you were here.
Sure.
For instance,
yes.
The introduction of females.
Yes, I would certainly want to speak about that. When I began here at St. Mary's in the fall of 67, there were practically no girls, no co-eds. My student assistant at the time was a co-ed, and she went on to study law. And I think that was probably a portent of things to come. I was lecturing to, digression from a lecture last year, I pointed out to a class in which there were three student girls going on to law school anyway, that under my own tutelage, I could count now three dozen female students who have gone on to law school. Some are still completing their law degree, and the bulk of them are practicing. And this year, for example, we had five from my jurisprudence courses co-eds accepted to law school, and that's the record of five. Nine altogether, but five of them were young ladies, and I hold that out to them, and that has been a change. 2 weeks ago, I received a phone call from a young woman, Antonia Miani, and she is now Dr. Miani. She's completed her political science at Northwestern, which is a very fine school in the States, And Tony was the one and only Queen Elizabeth Silver Jubilee medalist at St. Mary's. Then she went to Laval and Carleton and then ultimately Northwestern. So certainly that's a great change. Need I say, a great change for the better. And I might say too that it has added and I think cohered well with that tradition of caring and being personally interested. That I think that where people are breaking new ground, and in the early days they were breaking new ground, where they're breaking new ground, then the need for and the corresponding demand for the interest and the concern and the special advice is greater. And that one kind of thing kind of flowed into another, and you were working with male and female students, especially going to professional school and graduate school, but they kind of set a tone that might not have been there otherwise. I find that, if I may say, and you might disagree, but I find that there is a greater sensitivity with the young ladies, maybe less competitiveness in the worst sense of that term. Now that can be borne out by some writings and among feminists and all, Carol Gilligan and other boys and so forth. And I had experience of 4 years working with feminist law students and law professors at Dalhousie in the Charter Watch course in the early years of the Charter. And I would never want to see St. Mary's, and especially the political science department, become a place of the paper chase sort of ruthless competition. And if anything, I think that possible hard edge has been softened by the high incidence of the co-eds we've had that have gone on. Probably for majoring in poli-sci, the ones who've gone on who are co-eds, there's a higher percentage of them than men. And I speak of, say, law school and graduate school in political science. Our two doctorates in political science to date would be female. There's a third one coming who's a man. Our LLMs, which is sort of a law version of that, our LLMs are evenly apportioned between the two young ladies and two young men. And two of the LLMs, by the way, are married to one another, so that worked out nicely. That worked out nicely. But I think that reinforcement through saying where you sat, others sat, and go on, that probably has resonated greater with the young ladies than even with the men, although they're very appreciative of it. And then the response to that plays back over all the rest. So it's been I think that's been a much more important development than the addition of size, the additional size. The one is quantitative, the size. The other, I must tell you, is qualitative. We're a better school for it, the program is better for it, and the legal profession certainly better for it.
Are there any other differences you've noticed in the student populations over the years?
Oh, yes. The one that probably distresses me most, but there's not much you can do about it. Well, to backtrack, when I taught at St. Francis in Pennsylvania, it was mainly a residential college, but it's a university program, but they call it college. There's about very little graduate work. But it was, like St. Mary's in all other respects in the program, it was unheard of virtually for students to work. If they had a job, it was a token sort of campus job. And if there has been one negative development that I would single out, it has nothing to do with St. Mary's. It has nothing to do with the students in the sense that they haven't willed this. It's the sheer economic necessity for them to work. Certainly you must know this, that it's not unheard of for a student to work two jobs. When, of course, the job at hand really is the schoolwork. Now, as a practical matter, you have classes, and you have the coursework, and then you have a part-time job, or virtually a full-time job, in which you're rather dispensable in the present market. And comes a emergency request to work extra. And there's a test coming up, or a paper due, or a report. What gives way? It's going to have to be, I'm afraid, the academic. And then that's where the other part of St. Mary's does come in. And you need to take that into account. And at least they can feel, I think, some for us, I hope, certainly, most of us, that, well, they can come and say, look, what should I do? But they can't, some of them, really give up the job. And if they don't do what's required of them on the spot, they'll lose the job. And ergo, the academic side must suffer. Mm-hmm. If you had the magic wand to change one thing, I wouldn't change the size. I wouldn't change the movements in Nova Scotia for reorganization. I wouldn't change any of that necessarily, but I would change the need for our students to work. I don't mean just the usual little, check in the library type job. I mean that off-campus job where you're on call, and if you can't meet every obligation in the work, then you might lose a job.
Okay, have you noticed any difference in the ethnic origins of your students?
To some extent, oh, yes, I do. I want to speak about one point especially. And it relates directly to the work I spoke. I was in my field, in a sense. The law school, very commendably, came to the realization that minority practitioners of the law in Nova Scotia were very few. Now, I'm pleased to say that one of the established black lawyers in Nova Scotia, Paul Walter, is a former student of mine. I was his major tutor in honors. But he was not what they'd call an indigenous black in the not altogether satisfactory term. It just means native Nova Scotian. He was West Indian. He was West Indian. Paul practices law in the valley with two or three other of my former students. So I'm no stranger to that. And Kenrick Byron, who was also from St. Kitts in the West Indies, he took a master's degree in international relations at Carleton, then he took a law degree at Osgoode Hall. But they were forerunners and precursors, and that was before the law school made the effort to recruit minority students. As I say, Paul went to Dal, and Kenrick went to Osgoode Hall. But now they have what's called the IBM program, Indigenous Black and Mi'kmaq at the law school. And one of my former students, past student, excuse me, I slipped into that myself, the past student just got through there, one of the first of the IBMs. But this year is the vintage year. I had three Mi'kmaq students in my classes this year, and all three, I'm happy to say, have been accepted to law school. Mm-hmm. And each, of course, like all students, are individuals, and I spent time with each one, but each one was different. There were, and by the way, two girls and one and a boy. I would like to see, of course, more of that. The opportunities there at the law school and elsewhere. Ottawa has an IBM-type program, too. And we've had acceptances of, among those three at both Dal and Ottawa. And now, here's how this can work, though, Angela. A past student who went through here, sweeping all before him, with a double major in poli-sci and English, Peter Shea. Peter Shea was a Don, and he's completed his first year at Dal Law, and he was a Rhodes finalist from Newfoundland, Irish-Canadian origin. And one of the IBM students got into law school. Peter said to him, when he was working with him as a Don, that's when he says, you're going to wind up there. You're going to wind up there. And he did. Mm-hmm. That's a nice thing. Mm-hmm. That's really nice. But I'd like to see more of that, and I think in due course it will. Mm-hmm. That the student that Peter inspired, then came into my courses, but he already had that kind of idea planted and that motivation. And I will certainly think that that'll ripple back on others.
So in the early years when you were here, did you notice much of an ethnic diversity?
Very little, very little. With the exception, again, of Paul Walter and Ken McByron, who were Caribbean blacks. But it was very little. The names and the rosters would suggest, of course, mainly Nova Scotia's roots itself, Scottish Canadian names. It's probably, but let me backtrack a little bit too, though. Again, I must speak of those who weren't native to Canada. Lee Thomas was a great basketball player for St. Mary's in the 70s championship years. And he came out of one of those horrible ghettos in the United States. And he was a fine gentleman. He did very well academically, but he worked hard. But another story that I'm quite proud of is a fellow named Cliff Shockley. And Clifford was a black fellow from, again, one of those American ghettos like Newark, New Jersey, where indeed to have a member of the family slain was nothing. His own father was murdered. And he came here recruited, classic one, recruited to play basketball. And he dropped basketball. And again, to St. Mary's credit, we didn't drop him. And he took an MPA eventually at Dow and has a high administrative post in the New York transit system. So there were students before, but they tended to be either blacks from the Caribbean or American basketball players. The CIAU regulations now change a little bit of the recruiting. And it was nothing in the 70s to have three of the five starters recruited from the States. The rules preclude that now. But there certainly seems to be no lack of good black athletes at St. Mary's, but they'll now tend to be not so much American, but from here. Mm. So I guess I could speak to Angela most of kind of precursors or forerunners, very, very good people individuals as well as students, Cliff Shockley and Kenrick. Kenrick was one of the stars and leaders of my seminar in 82. And Paul Walter. What I would like to see now would be instead of one, three, four or more within a relatively small program like Valley Side. And last year was the year for the kids of the McMahons.
Have you noticed any changes in the ages of your students over the years?
Not too much, actually, because for some reason, in my courses, we never lack for seasoned individuals. The gentleman who just got his degree last year at such an advanced age, 85, Samuel Prowse Murdoch, was a student of mine. And he was in that seminar with Kenrick Byron and Lynn Connors and Carol Field and all of them, and they really enjoyed taking classes with him. And he added a lot to it because they would know from my classes figures out of American law and politics like Felix Frankfurter and James Farley. He would have met them because he was a business executive in the States for many years, although native of Prince Edward Island. So Samuel Prowse Murdoch was kind of the leaven in the dough earlier. And then in another development in the late 60s, early 70s, I think owing to a very generous policy then on the part of the Canadian military, veteran officers, more or less veteran officers would go to class. And I had a number of them, and they were first rate. They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they did it. And they were high-ranking men. Some of them, one had commanded the Bonaventure, the last commander, captain of the Bonaventure. Others were pilots, the Terrier pilots when they still had the Terrier, and another retired as a rear admiral, and didn't have all that rank at the time, and that was a good mix. Mm-hmm. You have people like that, and I had in constitutional law once. He's a lawyer now, but he was a serving Halifax policeman at the time. And one day, fortuitously, when we were doing rights of the accused in American constitutional law, he happened to come into class in his uniform. He just had a break that day, and so quantitatively, as I couldn't say that I've added so many. It's just about the same of a number of individuals. There's a Canadian Forces commander in my classes this year, and coming into classes in the fall for me, and he'd be of the same stripe as those other men.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the faculty and the actual changes that you've seen in your department over the years.
Okay.
How has the faculty that you've worked with changed?
Well, there is a couple of obvious points. As with the student body, the once all male poli sci faculty has now become 5-3, I guess, male and female. I have the highest regard. I don't just say this policy, I have the highest regard for our female faculty members. Dr. Royal was tragically very ill now, but. And didn't get to teach you too much, but Professor Keeble, Dr. Arsenal, outstanding. And I think that's excellent. It can be invaluable in every respect, but certainly in that I think that the co-eds that you wish to motivate, I hold out so many others who've gone before them, who've done so well. But then that isn't an abstraction to them, because I make it as concrete as I can. But then they go into the next class and have a highly accomplished professor with an Oxford degree or something like that, and very interested in them too. They fit outstandingly into that mold of being interested with them. They really, really put that way. And I know, and I don't want to go into detail, but where students needed help, they gave help. And so that's the principal change. And a correlative one, to put this, I say they're getting, the faculty's getting younger in the department, which is another way of saying I'm getting older. But there was a long stretch there in poli-sci where it was a settled faculty. We were just there, we were veterans. At one point, I think most of us were closing on 20 years or 15 years. And then owing to death and retirement, they came younger. And I regard that as a positive development, too. And I must tell you, as far as faculty, and I would say this from my experience in poli-sci, but it certainly must be true at St. Mary's in general, the younger faculty have a very, very exacting regimen to get ahead in the profession now. It is not any longer possible, perhaps, to concentrate as much on the day-to-day teaching as before, because of demands of research and demands of professional activity. I happen to think the people in the department, the young ones, do an outstanding job of balancing those many things. I don't mean just the female younger members either, obviously. I mean Dr. Malls too, because he, in addition to all of which, has enormous administrative responsibilities. The aforementioned Tony Mayani put it very well. She's teaching at Ottawa. And her husband teaches political science at the University of Montreal, imagine. And she has a commute back and forth and all that. And she told me, because she would tell me, that she did very well in her course evaluations at Ottawa. But she had a good phrase, sports analogy. She says, the hoop is getting smaller. And they play with a smaller hoop, our younger faculty. And I'd say, as a challenge to St. Mary's as a university, in addition to growth and all of that and maintaining our own best view of ourselves, we need to take care of our young faculty. give them the chance to do everything that's required of them in the profession. Whatever can be done. At the very least, veteran professors can be there for advice and can shoulder as much of the load as you possibly can so it doesn't all fall on younger shoulders. That can't help but be a positive development to have younger faculty. As I say, it's the thing I used to say about the students. They get younger every year. Of course, they don't. I just get older. But the fact that the political science department faculty, the half of it is relatively young. I mean, that's by any standard, relatively young. And that's good. That's very good. It's hard on them, but it's good.
Okay. Are there any other changes over time that you've noticed? Or...
Well, yes, it's certainly a correlative of growth. The physical aspect has deteriorated. Now, it's no indictment, it's just in the nature of things. If a classroom, for example, has every available seat taken up, that detracts a little from the physical setting. That means that books and paraphernalia are piled in the aisles and for the kind of thing I like to do every now and again, move among them early in the early going, just to get the name down, you know, that sort of thing, the face to a name. It tends to be like an obstacle course. And some of the other classrooms have just plain deteriorated. But the opening of the East Wing has been helpful. And I taught there last year, and that was a first-rate classroom. But again, it was chock-a-block with the students, and it held the 50 students they had in there to start with comfortably. But that was just it. Everybody was there in the place. So we could use more space. We could probably use more office space. Our own arrangement in Poli Sci isn't the greatest. Some offices are removed from others. There is this bank right down here. And for younger profs, I think it's nice if they encounter something. Sometimes they can encounter something they want to just take up with an older prof. Have you ever had this before with this type of student, this sort of thing? It's nice to just pop right in the office. Ideally, you'd have all departments with a bank of offices. Also, super ideally, you'd have the classrooms rather set by department.
Mm-hmm.
I like to, as long as I've been in the profession, and I'll be doing it again this fall, when classrooms are assigned to me and they're unfamiliar, before the first day of classes I go and check them out. I'm congenitally incapable of not doing that. You like that setting. And when on the first day, let us say a classroom you checked out, you know, it's not going to prove suitable because there are too many in it. You know, there's a change.
Yeah.
So if we could build another building, we'd be much better off. And we'd be justified in doing it the way we run the school. We don't cost the province as much money as some other operations.
Mm. That's about all I wanted to cover.
Okay.
Is something you'd like to add?
Maybe just as kind of a quota to it all, most of my remarks have been, I realize positive, the view I take of things. And the negatives really are best seen as challenges. I would add one thought, because I've been reflecting upon this to a considerable degree. St. Mary's really isn't engulfed by its numbers. In this sense, we do have that tradition and that own best view of ourselves as an institution that maybe equips us better than any I can think of to handle that situation. Now there's a new development, and it's probably this, that one degree, if you please, is no longer enough. And now we have to handle that one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very cognizant of the fact that I will push students on for another degree, be it law or be it academic in political science. But what happens when we have to push twice as many? Dr. Knowles and I probably, between us, wrote 170 letters of recommendation this year, which is, you know, considerable number. I relish that, but I take a great deal of time on each letter, each form. We set a record for getting people to law school this year, 9. The old record was 7. And I was very pleased to be able to do that when the hoop gets smaller there, too, because that's 3 times as many applications as the year we set the record. But that's not enough anymore, in the sense that we need to send as many people as possibly can, not necessarily professional school, but to some sort of postgraduate work. For example, one of our, just to add one thought on this, Maureen Google is also a Mi'kmaq woman, and she took courses in me last year, and she went on to journalism at Ryerson, and I was very pleased just this spring, the last few weeks, her byline bobs up continuously in the Mail Star, the local paper. And I think one of his values I asked was to develop students for, say, graduate work in fields other than political science and law, but journalism being one. So that's how I kind of add or finish my quota by saying, I think I may be in the minority in this field, but I think St. Mary's is well equipped to master the challenge of change in size. But there's a change that's not just quantitative, but qualitative. And what if, as we approach the 21st century, 1 degree isn't enough? We've got to adjust to that, too. So how's that for you? Is that good enough?
That's great.
Okay, great.
I know I'm